Hi, this is Martha Burtis from the Division of Teaching and Learning Technologies at the University of Mary Washington. Up next from Faculty Academy 2006, we'll be hearing Rachel Smith from the New Media Consortium speaking about gaming and education.
Welcome back, everyone, to our second plenary session for the day and our first presentation by one of our distinguished guest speakers, Rachel Smith of the New Media Consortium. Let me give you the biographical details, and then I will share with you my Rachel story from the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative annual meeting. Rachel is the Director of Special Projects and Publications for the New Media Consortium, where she works with member institutes on NMC projects and new opportunities for collaboration among members. She's directing the Pachyderm Project currently, and there's a workshop tomorrow afternoon on the Pachyderm Project, which reminds me of another Rachel story, but I'll get to that. And she's also involved in the ongoing Horizon Project. She worked at the California State University Center for Distributed Learning before she came to NMC. She was involved there with the development of a pioneering learning object repository called Merlot. She also worked with Biology Labs Online and other projects, and Rachel holds a master's degree in education from Stanford University. Here are my two Rachel stories. One is, I saw her do a presentation on Pachyderm at EDUCAUSE, I think it was just last fall, right? Where the server was not cooperating. So she is one of those presenters who can present on an online project skillfully, compellingly, enough to have conversion experiences happening all over the place, even when the equipment's not working. That's a skill that's a skill we should all cultivate if we're going to work with technology. The second Rachel story is that I heard her speak on gaming at the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative annual meeting in San Diego just this past, I guess it was late January, was it? And she spoke of it as an educator. She spoke of gaming in education as someone who's also a developer and an avid gamer herself. She also spoke about it as a parent, which is something that I know a lot of us are thinking about, especially if we have any children at home. Gaming is something that children are fascinated by, and the gaming culture is quite widespread among children. And her perspective was fascinating because of getting more buttons on the bar. Is that correct? Your six-year-old was always thrilled to get more buttons on the bar. Yep. Rachel can explain to you exactly what that means, but it was at that moment I said, we've got to get Rachel Smith to talk to Faculty Academy. We're really pleased to have her here today. Please welcome Rachel Smith.
I'll try to speak up. If I kind of get soft, which I tend to do, wave at me and I'll speak up again. I am indeed going to show you how to get buttons on the bar and other things. And thank you for that lovely introduction. So I am here to talk about games and gaming and education. And I wasn't actually going to reveal the fact that I am an online gamer. I was going to try to conceal that. It probably honestly would have come through by the end of the talk anyway, but that's okay. But I figured it would help my credibility if you didn't know that right at the time. Too late now. So best to just dive in. Okay, so games and education. Right off the bat, how many of you are gamers yourselves? A handful. Okay, good. So how does this topic make you feel? Well, if you are a gamer, you're probably excited that somebody's actually standing here going to talk to you about games. That's, like, really cool, right? Wow, here we are, learning something, and it's about games. That's awesome. If you're not a gamer, how does this topic make you feel? Maybe? Okay. Yeah? Okay. So this is a little cartoon that I like to use. For those of you who can't see it, which I think everybody has now seen it. The punchline is, can you hang on a sec? I think I just took another picture of my ear. And the man's on his cell phone. And this is kind of, you know, maybe you're kind of feeling like this. Like, I know I did this when I first got my cell phone. I took pictures of all kinds of things. When I was trying to dial, I would take pictures of the floor and, you know. And you're kind of at this place where you're thinking, okay, when I played games, maybe I played Sorry. I remember playing Sorry. How is Sorry educational? How, you know, I'm not going to ask my students to sit down and play Life, because yeah, it's fun, but they're not going to learn anything. They're just going to waste time. And maybe there's a fear that, you know, that you'll end up taking a picture of your ear if you try to bring this
into your classrooms. And that's certainly a possibility. I'm not going to lie to you. But so where do we start? Well, today let's start just by talking about... How many of you know what this is called? Sudoku. How many of you know how to play it? How many of you want me to just be quiet for 5 minutes?
Put the one up there.
This is just a picture. I can't actually interact with this particular Sudoku puzzle, but if you now crave it, you can go to www.websudoku.com and you can fill it in online. And Sudoku, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, does not require any mathematical ability at all. It's a logic puzzle. You just have to fill in the numbers 1 through 9 in each of these blocks, such that in every square, the numbers 1 through 9 only appear once. In every line, the numbers 1 through 9 only appear once. And in every line, this way, your numbers 1 through 9 only appear once. So it's sort of a what can you put here, what can you put there kind of puzzle. And Sudoku has actually been around since the 1970s, but it recently became extremely popular, first in Japan, where, incidentally, it was not invented in Japan. But it became very popular in Japan and then kind of made its way over here. And if you go on an airplane anywhere now, as you walk up and down the aisle, you will see people playing Sudoku, I can guarantee it. It's a great way to pass the time on the flight. These are a couple of online games. Sudoku you can play online, but you can also play it in a newspaper like a crossword, so you don't need to be online to do that. These ones are online games, and I'm actually going to show you these two games here in just a second. The point that I want to make about these two is that these are two examples of really, really simple games. I mean, these games did not take a lot of thought to develop. Puzzle Cheap has some cute graphics, so that took a little bit more time to make the graphics and make it all work. This game is pretty much what you see there. I mean, that's the whole game. And I'll show you how it works in just a second if you haven't seen it. But you can play these games in just a few seconds for the one on the bottom, or a few minutes for Puzzle Cheap, or you can spend hours playing Puzzle Cheap because there are levels, and people naturally want to complete levels and achieve goals and keep moving on. This one's a beat-your-time kind of game, so eventually you hit a ceiling there. Let's take a quick look at these. Miniclip.com has a whole lot of games like Puzzle Cheap. And the object with Puzzle Cheap is to get your sheep onto the target. And the thing about this is that you turn it down just a little. Okay, a little too much. Is that you don't get to steer the sheep. You have to set down arrows and then the sheep... You have to steer the sheep and you put down the arrows, and when the sheep get to the arrows, they turn. So you have to work out all the steering in advance. And it starts out very easy and then gets harder. So for this particular one, I'm going to put a down arrow right here and then make my sheep go, and he goes into the target. Yay. It gets harder later. You get more sheep, you get less time, and there are things like ponds that if your sheep falls into the pond, he'll drown with this little drowning animal. Yeah, I know, it's very sad. There are wolves that eat the sheep. And you know, so you feel very protective toward these sheep. You really want them to succeed, that kind of thing. I think you get the idea. And let's go to... Well, we'll do it the long way around. You know the podium time? Are you familiar with podium time? You get up here and a second is like 4 hours. And you can no longer work your computer. Okay. This one is even easier. Click and hold the red square. Move it around so that you don't touch the walls or get hit by the flying objects. And if you make it to 18 seconds, you're doing brilliantly. Okay, I'm very over-caffeinated this morning, so let's see how we do here. Ooh. Ooh. This computer, I just realized, this is a new computer. It's also a good deal faster than my previous computer. Ooh, hit the wall. One more time.
Whoa.
All right. 4.11 seconds. Thank you very much. So that's like the quickest coffee break in history. And I showed this to my boss, and he said, "You play that during work time?" And I said, "What, I can't take a 5-second break?"
Yeah.
So he saw the justice of that in the end. But the point here is that these are really simple, but really engaging, despite the music on the sheet game. Really engaging. And games can pull people in. Games can make people want to continue, because there's a concrete, a clear goal that you're trying to reach. And something that is also true about education is that there are concrete goals that you try to reach. So there might be a match there. Let's keep looking. Let's try that. Okay. Those are really simple games. This is a really complicated game. Anybody know what this one is?
WoW.
WoW. World of Warcraft. More about this in a little bit. But this one is very different from the other ones in that it's not a solitary game. It takes a lot of time to do, and it has a very complicated interface. It takes a long time to learn. But it's equally engaging. Games don't have to be simple to be engaging. They can be very complicated. It is not inherently educational. It's an entertainment game. And I am not going to stand here and tell you that you should all have your classes in World of Warcraft, because you shouldn't. But I just want to show you what 5 million people worldwide spend about 20 hours a week doing. Seriously.
20 hours.
Possibly more. We'll get back to that later. So what those three things, those three or four games have in common, they set up a situation by having rules. So you have to, in order to play the game, you have to play by the rules. So people go into the situation and they agree to be bound by these completely arbitrary laws in order to accomplish a completely arbitrary goal. And people have no problem with that. I went in there and showed you electric sheep and I said, you have to get your sheep to the target. And if your sheep falls in the water, it will drown. And what was your reaction? Okay. Keep the sheep away. Okay, some people don't care. Keep the sheep away from the water. You care about the sheep. This is a sheep that you didn't even see before this morning, and you already don't want it to fall in the water. And I heard you people. I heard you saying, aw. Players work within the rules to accomplish a goal or goals. You can just give them this arbitrary goal, give them the rules. They want to do it. Obviously, there are sucky games that nobody wants to play. And nobody, not everybody likes the same games. There's some of you who, if I made you sit down and play Electric Sheep, you would go stir crazy inside of 10 minutes. And that's fine, I'm not going to make you do it. But there's a wide variety of games out there. And almost everybody likes to play something. Each game requires a certain amount of focus to succeed. Now, I've seen this with my son, whom Gardner alluded to. He's 6 years old, my son and my partner. And you think of a six-year-old as not being able to focus on anything for very long. But that's actually not true. And those of you who have had intense experiences with six-year-olds maybe realize that. But when he's interested in something, he can sit there for hours and do nothing but that. And most of the things he's interested in are games or toys. He really likes Legos. But he can just sit there and focus. And games help people focus if they're interested in the game because of that thing of reaching goals and of mastering rules. And those are things that people respond to. The examples I showed you are all purely entertainment games. Those are not educational games. Even Sudoku, not really educational. It may help develop logic skills, and certainly there are harder ones and easier ones, but you're not going to learn much other than basic logic by playing Sudoku. So let's talk about some educational games. This one is called Live Long and Prosper, and it was developed at MIT. It's designed to be played on a handheld device, like a Palm, or some little PDA. And it's designed for young people, for kids, to learn about genetics. And what happens here is each child gets a PDA with the game on it. And the PDAs communicate wirelessly. The children choose what they want their creature to look like, or to be like. There are different attributes, so you can choose gender, longevity, aging rate, childhood disease, and fertility. So these different properties you can set on a sliding scale where your creature is. And the object is for your creature to live as long as possible, and then mate and have offspring, and for the offspring to live as long as possible. And that's sort of your creature, you become the offspring, and then the next one, and then the next one. And so the score is basically who's alive the longest. And the way that the creatures mate is you walk over to somebody who has wireless and a palm, and your things communicate wireless. Your critters mate, and then you walk away and you've got a new one, a new generation. So what are we teaching them here?
Genetics!
I don't know what you people are thinking. But they begin to understand how these different factors, longevity and fertility rates and that sort of thing, influence reproduction and how long a species lasts, how long a generation lasts. They begin to understand what a generation means, which is a really hard concept for a child who's been alive for 12 years, to really understand what a generation is, how long a generation is, and that it's not a set period of time. You know, you can't say a generation is 50 years. A generation is a sort of moving thing. Live Long and Prosper, from MIT. Second Life. I'm going to show you Second Life a little bit later. How many of you have seen Second Life? It's not a game. Second Life is not a game. It's an online virtual environment. It's a world online. And you can play games in Second Life, but you can also do work in Second Life, which is something that I do sometimes. And I'll talk about that more later. But Live Long and Prosper is very simple, designed to be played on handhelds. Second Life is very complicated. It's built by the people who are using it. There are people who actually make their living in Second Life. They actually earn money by being in Second Life. Wow, how's that possible? Let's all quit, right? Go do stuff in Second Life. And the possibilities for what you can do in Second Life are just beginning to unfold in terms of education. A lot of Second Life is a social space. So if you just log in for the first time and you go to a popular location, you will probably see things that you would expect to see on the wrong side of the tracks in a big city after midnight. And a lot of Second Life is like that. But there are areas in Second Life that are specifically educationally focused. And I'm going to show you one of those later. We're not going to go to the other kind of place. Yes. If you want to do that, you have to do that on your own. So this whole gaming thing, compare it for a minute to comic books and manga. I know this is going to be a favorable comparison for all of you. Manga, by the way, is what you see here. It's a Japanese style of comic book. It actually means comic book in Japan. It's any comic book. But then when you talk about manga outside of Japan, it's Japanese comic books. And comic books have been around for a while, and for a long time comic books were, and to some degree they still are, but not nearly as badly as they were, they had a very negative connotation. You know, comic books were something that wasted kids, that were hidden away, that you really didn't want your kids reading comic books. And then a couple of librarians said, you know what, I have a kid here who doesn't read at all. If this kid can start reading a comic book, that's reading. They're reading something. And gradually comic books became not so bad, and you know, now people collect them, they're worth a lot of money. But they went through this sort of, you know, denigrated period, and then sort of, well, maybe it's okay. And now comic books are pretty mainstream, wouldn't you say? You know, you don't think somebody's weird because they read comic books. And we've also recognized that comic books have not replaced textbooks. Wow. But you can still learn things from comic books. There are comic books that can teach you how to cook. Especially in Japan, manga is used for manuals, for tutorials. The frame-by-frame lends itself really well to step-by-step instruction. And also, coincidentally, to being transferred onto cell phones and handhelds. Because you just take the little frame, pop it on the cell phone. When you read it, you hit next, you go to the next one. So there are some educational uses there. But it's taken some time. And I would like to say the same thing is going to be true for gaming, that there are educational uses there, but it's going to take some time. It's not ready yet. So what am I not talking about? Let's just get that out of the way right now so that you're not sitting there waiting for me to say these things. I'm not going to say it. I'm not talking about unguided learning. I'm not talking about sitting kids in a room and having them play games all day and claiming that's an education. Absolutely not. I'm not talking about replacing teachers with games. Books didn't replace teachers. Comic books didn't replace teachers. The internet hasn't replaced teachers. Games are not going to replace teachers. They're really not. Using games in places where they don't make sense. I'm not saying that you should immediately go out and find a game that's, you know, somehow tangentially related to your discipline and start using it, or you're a bad person. I'm not saying that at all. If it doesn't make sense to teach something using a game, don't. Don't. Teach it the way it makes sense to teach it. Games are just going to become a tool that you can use in situations where they will help. I'm not talking about cramming education into entertainment-based games. I don't believe that you can have your class set up accounts on World of Warcraft and go in there and have meaningful class experiences, except in a few very isolated cases that mostly have to do with anthropology and social studies and observing social interactions with people, in which case World of Warcraft is like going to another culture. But other than that, it's a game, it's a toy, it's entertainment. It's not educational. But that doesn't mean that none of them are. That's kind of the thing that I want you to leave here with today. That just because some games are purely entertainment, not all of them are. They don't all have to be. I did a study last year, which at the time I was not I was not happy with doing, because it meant I had to travel all over the country for long periods of time and be away from my son, and I had to drag around video equipment, which I hate, and I had to interview people, which I don't mind so much, but I had to interview at 5 different colleges and universities. I had to interview the faculty, the TA, and at least 5 students from each of 8 courses. So if you do the math, that's a lot of people. And I was at each place for 3 or 4 days. So it was basically back-to-back interviews. And, you know, people cancel, they don't show up, you've got to reschedule. It's just a huge nightmare. Logistical pain. And then the equipment doesn't work, all kinds of stuff. But now I'm really glad that I did it. Because I was asking them questions about how the experience of being in a classroom is different now than it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago. I was asking that of the faculty when they were students. What's different now for the students than for them? How do they teach differently from the way their professors taught them? And for the students, I was asking, what's it like to be in the classroom today? Just, you know, tell me what your experiences are during the day. And one of the things that I took away from this, which really, it kind of astonished me that the students brought this up. And the study was sort of focused on technology. Is technology making a difference? And the students kept saying, well, the technology is great, but the class is good because of the teacher. Or the class is bad because of the teacher. Technology doesn't make it better or a lot worse. There are times when the technology helps. There are times when the technology gets in the way. But the deciding factor in whether a student enjoys a course and gets a lot out of the course is you guys, is the faculty. That's what matters to the students. And whatever tools you choose to use, it's still the fact that you show up, the fact that you care, and the fact that you make it a place where the students can learn that makes a difference. And the students know that. And they told me that. I didn't ask them that. They just told me that spontaneously. Incidentally, another thing I got out of the study is that a lot of faculty would say, you know, I'd say, what technology do you use in your courses? And they'd say, well, I use PowerPoint. And then I'd ask their students, what technology do your faculty use in the courses? And they'd say, well, they don't really use technology. They use PowerPoint. Take away from that what you will. So what is this whole thing about educational gaming anyway? Where did this come from? What's going on now? Is there any there? Is it really serious? It is. It's just beginning, but it is. The Horizon Report, which the New Media Consortium puts out every year, this year's copy, which you can download off our website, has a section on educational gaming, and it's been placed in the midterm horizon. So the near horizon is 1 year or less, the midterm is 2 to 3 years, and then 4 to 5 years is the next one. So, and I should say it's actually New Media Consortium and EDUCAUSE. Sorry, Cyprian, didn't mean to shaft you guys with the credit there. It's a collaboration between the two. So educational gaming is, we believe, 2 to 3 years out, which means that in some places it's already happening, and it's gaining momentum, and in 2 to 3 years it will be present on university campuses in pretty much a big way. The entertainment... I always forget what this is called. Entertainment Software Association, I think, has done several reports and studies, essential facts about online games and games in general. There's an interesting report on court cases involving video games, in which the decision repeatedly comes down on the side of there's no hard evidence that video games increase violence in youth. So the media likes to report that there is, but the studies that have been done are inconclusive. So we're still waiting to hear about that one for sure. And then the last page over there is from Daedalus.com. I'll show you more about that in a minute. But it's this research project whose sole purpose is to do formal research into online games and find out why people are playing them, who's playing them, what they get out of it, what the good effects are, what the bad effects are, all that sort of thing. So there's a lot of thought going into this topic. There's a lot of actual research happening in this topic. It's the beginning of a discipline. And we're sort of standing at the edge of the big field and kind of waiting to move out into it and see what's there. But people are taking it seriously. And there are serious things that we can learn from this discipline about how people interact with engaging content and about what captures people's interests and how to make goals that people want to motivate themselves to achieve. This is the Daedalus Project, which I mentioned a minute ago. I encourage you to go there and check it out if you're curious. It's focused specifically on massively multiplayer online games, also known as massively multiplayer online role-playing games, although that's a misnomer because not all of them are role-playing. So they're now called MMOs, massively multiplayer onlines. And that's how I'll refer to them because it's easier to say. But Nick Yee is the guy who's done most of this research, and this research has been going on for maybe 5 or 6 years now. He's surveyed over 30,000 people, players, game players, and he's got all kinds of data that relate to different questions that he's looking into. So he does a survey that's based on a specific research question, and some of them are gender differences in why people play games. Why do women play games? Why do men play games? Which is very applicable to young people, to girls and boys, and you know what motivates girls, what motivates boys. He's done research into engagement versus addiction, because there's a big question of, are these video games addictive in a harmful way? Or are they just engaging? And how can you tell the difference? Where can you draw the line and say, this person's engaged, that person's addictive? There are some serious game design degree programs, and this is actually the one, it's an animated, so it kind of goes back and forth. But the one I want you to see is this guy here who's saying, without guys like me, you'd still be playing Pong. Which is an excellent point. Media have gotten a lot more complicated than they used to be. And I'm going to use an example from, it's either Blink or The Tipping Point, and I'm sorry, I can't remember which one it is, but it's the same author. Which is that when the TV show Dragnet came out, people watched Dragnet and they thought, wow, this is great TV, which, you know, at the time it was. And there's been a survey or research into the plot complexity of Dragnet. And basically, the plot complexity of Dragnet is, in the first segment of the show, there's a little subplot, and then there's the plot, and then at the end of the show, there's a little subplot. And that was good TV at the time. That was, you know, engaging. People sat there and watched it. But now TV shows have stacks of plots that are interwoven, and you get a little bit of one and a little bit of the next one, a little bit of the first one, a little bit of this other one. And they're extended over shows. They go from week to week to week, whereas Dragnet was contained in one show, in one 30-minute episode, hour episode, what was it? 30. And so people are more used to dealing with complex plots. They're more used to dealing with plots that carry on. And people who were raised on today's TV are amazingly bored watching Dragnet because it's so obvious and simple. That doesn't mean it's bad television. It just means it's older television. And media is moving that way. Games are moving that way. Board games, online games are more complicated than Sorry. The rules are harder to learn, the rules take longer to learn, and people are okay with that. People want that. That's fulfilling to people these days. So I'm glad we're not playing Pong. Not that I don't ever play Pong. Pong is fun. But Pong requires no brain power, and I don't regard it as diverting as World of Warcraft. There are degree programs in game design. We're actually training people to develop good games and giving them college degrees in that topic, which I think is fabulous. That's a first step toward getting better games. getting games that can be used in education, is training people in how to design games, how to design characters, how to design interactions, how to design strategies, game theory, how's the progression of the game going to go. This is from the Digital Gaming and Simulation Program at Houston Community College Southwest. And this is just the... I see it's cut off at the bottom. It's sort of the how many hours per topic in this course. So in 64 hours, they spend 8 hours reverse engineering a design document for an existing game. So they take it apart, see what makes it go. And then they write a design document about it. They spend 4 hours evaluating existing games, talking about what makes them fun, what do players expect, why is simulation important, and experimenting with traditional and computer games. So just different things that they do that actually is academic. It teaches people how to make good games. Cool. Research into girls and games, specifically, or boys and games. In this case, it's both, although when you hear about it, you typically hear about the girls because less research is done on girls and games. Alien Games, which is aliengames.org, is a research project from Michigan State University. And the question is, do girls design games that are more appealing to girls than games designed by boys? And do boys design games that are more appealing to boys than games designed by girls? So if you want to read the report, go there. But basically, a couple of little things that they found out, preliminary findings. This is still, they're still analyzing all the research and going on and stuff. But preliminary findings is that of the games that they designed, and there were 14 or 19 or something, they asked girls to rate all the games and boys to rate all the games. Girls and boys did not choose the same games as the most fun. Whoa! Imagine that. Girls did like games that were designed by girls, and the games that were designed by girls shared certain characteristics that were not present in the games designed by boys. One example. Games designed by girls had, not that they had no killing, some of them did, you had to kill the bad guy, but the player didn't die as much. Because that's not as amusing to a girl, apparently. Guys, on the other hand, that was part of the game. It had to be tough. You had to be challenged. You had to die a lot, or it just wasn't fun. Interesting. There's more. Aliengames.org. Game theory. GameTheory.net, which, and this is from GameTheory.net, from their website. They advertise it for educators, students, professionals, and geeks. So apparently that's who's interested in game theory. You can decide which of those is you. Or not. But they've got all kinds of resources. They've got lecture notes, so notes online for whatever discipline for teaching about games or with games or for games. Reviews of textbooks that involve game theory. Quizzes and tests. All kinds of resources there. You can go and check them out if you're interested in experimenting or finding out more. But the point of all this is that people are taking this seriously. And that's the first step, is for people to take it seriously. It's still a baby field, but it's a field. So you remember learning objects? Everybody remembers learning objects? Fondly? Not so fondly? Whatever. When I first started talking about learning objects, which was a long time ago, I would stand up there and I would say, okay, I'm going to talk about learning objects. And people would say, what the heck is a learning object? I don't get it. I don't know what a learning object is. Well, we've all kind of come to this point where now we've learned about learning objects, we've used learning objects, some of us have made learning objects, we're tired of learning objects, can we move on, please? Games are following that same arc, and they're going to do the same kind of thing. Right now, I'm standing up here talking about games, and you're sitting there going, I don't see this, I'm sorry, I like you, I really want to hear what you're saying, but I don't see this happening. I don't understand what it is. That's okay, you will. And 4 or 5 years from now, we'll all be going, well, I'm glad that's over. That part was a joke. So learning objects, you can have good ones, you can have bad ones, you can have really simple ones, you can have more complicated, interactive ones.
Tell us about learning objects. I don't know what the hell that is.
The same thing applies to games. Okay, a learning object is basically basically anything that is presents content in a meaningful way, ties content together in a meaningful way, and is connected to a learning goal, a learning objective. So your map of Africa by itself is not a learning object because there's no goal there. And I can label all the countries and it's still not a learning object. But if I tie an educational goal to it and an activity to it, it becomes a learning object. So a learning object can be anything. Really, I mean, books can be learning objects. Quizzes can be learning objects. Pieces of paper that have, you know, that you fill out a worksheet can be a learning object. The big buzz was learning objects that are online and interactive, like this one, where it says, where is Angola? And you click Angola, and it says yes or no. But again, if you don't tie this to an educational objective and use it in a meaningful way, it's exactly the same as that map. It lets you do drills, but it's exactly the same as the map. So the big thing behind learning objects was connecting them in a meaningful way to your educational objectives and making that explicit. And that's going to be true for games as well. The big thing with games is going to be having it connected to what you want to teach anyway. So there are going to be good games, there are going to be bad games. Just like you did with learning objects, you're going to have to evaluate the games that you think you might want to use and decide whether they fit your needs. Just like learning objects, you have to decide if you want to make it or if you want to find one and use it, if you want to buy one or use one that's free. Just like learning objects, they're going to be game repositories. Hopefully they'll be the same because I don't want to go through that again. And you can go there and search and find games which are really a kind of learning object anyway. But we're still a few years from all that. So motivation. How do games tie into motivation? Learning, as we know, is assisted by engagement in the topic on the part of the learner. Someone who wants to learn something will learn it faster than someone who does not. Someone who is ready to learn something will learn it faster than someone who is not. That's pretty basic. When you plan your teaching, you build on what students know, and you take them a little further. And that's how learning occurs, is by taking new knowledge, attaching it to a framework that's already existing, and then pushing it a little bit. Games do that really well. Good ones, good games are engaging. And as I said earlier, different games are engaging to different people. So just because a game is not engaging to everybody doesn't mean it's not a good game. But it may be that one size doesn't fit all. Darn it! When is that ever going to be true in education? That would make life so much easier. Games in the workplace. There was an interview not too long ago of adults who play World of Warcraft and similar online games. And one of the things about World of Warcraft is that a lot of the time that you're playing it, you're not doing exciting stuff. You're doing what's called grinding, which is doing the same thing over and over and over and over to attain some kind of goal. For example, if you want a particular piece of equipment, like a really good sword, you have to make it or find someone to make it. But they need materials. Maybe you need steel. Maybe you need iron. If you need iron, for example, you have to mine it or find somebody who's a miner to go mine it. And the way that you mine iron in World of Warcraft is you run around looking for iron deposits, and then you click on them, and your character goes, and you get iron, and then it goes, and you get more iron, and you need a lot of iron to make a sword. So people will go in and spend hours getting iron to get this sword, which is virtual, but they really want it. And honestly, they will go in, and I've done this. I mean, yes. Okay, and you do the same thing over and over again because you want to attain this goal, which has meaning only to you in the context of the game. Right now, standing here, I have no credibility with you whatsoever because I have a better sword than anybody else. But when I'm in the game, that matters. So someone did this interview, and they talked to this man who works hard all day at work. And then they said, well, what do you do when you go home? And he says, I log into World of Warcraft. I said, cool. And does that help you unwind? And he said, well, yeah, most of the time. And I said, what do you mean most of the time? And he said, well, sometimes I'm grinding. And I come home from work, and I sit down at the computer, and man, I'm 4 hours mining iron, and I'm so tired when it's done. And the interviewer said, well, why do you do it? And the guy looked at it and said, well, because I want to. So someone read this interview, and I don't know the actual details. I really need to track this down. I was unable to find it before, 10 o'clock this morning. But there are folks who are looking into ways to make repetitive work easier and more fun by turning it into an online game. So you go and you mine the iron, and it actually does whatever menial task, repetitive task you do all day for work. Not obviously for faculty. Wouldn't it be great if you could play World of Warcraft and when you were done, your grades would be finished? That'd be awesome. So this is kind of like that, only for people who sit there and do the same thing repetitively over and over and over again all day. And the idea is, if it's something that they're more engaged in, something that's more fun to do, they'll perform better, they'll perform faster, they'll perform more accurately, and they'll have a better quality of life. What can we learn from games? Boy, I've kind of been talking about this all along, what we can learn from games. But specifically, what we can learn from playing games. First and foremost, you learn the rules of the game. That may not suit your educational objective, but you got to take that with the rest of it. Because you can't play a game without learning the rules. I have some friends that we get together and play games sometimes. And I have one friend who is extremely into game theory and strategy. I mean, really, really over the top. Likes to design games as you're playing them. And he has this annoying habit of changing the rules in the middle of the game to make it more balanced, more satisfying to him. It drives me crazy! Because I like to learn the rules and understand the boundaries and then play within the boundaries. If that changes in the middle, I just go all to pieces. So you learn the rules to play it. Understanding strategy comes later. For some of us, it comes a lot later. I learned the rules to chess. I'm still very bad at the strategy of chess. Most of you could probably beat me at chess. Even the ones who don't know how to play chess right now. Cooperation for multiplayer games. Games like World of Warcraft, a lot of people are playing at the same time. These are people you don't know. You can get on there and play with your friends, but more often than not, you're playing with total strangers. And so you've got to cooperate with someone you don't know, you can't see, you've never spoken to before, and who may or may not type in complete sentences. And you have to get along with people. You don't know how old they are. You don't know if they're 12. You don't know if they're 47. You don't really know if they're a boy or a girl, man, woman, whatever. But you have to cooperate with them to attain a common goal. Concentration for solo games. You're playing solitaire. Some levels of solitaire let your mind kind of wander and rest. Some solo games, you really have to concentrate on what you're doing. For sports, you learn physical coordination. For games involving manual dexterity, it improves your hand-eye coordination. Fast-paced video games have been shown to increase the pace at which people can make decisions because you get used to making faster decisions. And for Twitch games, which I am terrible at, they can improve your hand-eye coordination and your reflexes right up until they give you carpal tunnel syndrome. And as I mentioned before, games are more complicated than they used to be. The rules are harder. People are okay with that. It takes longer to complete them. People are okay with that. You can sit down and play a game of Sorry with your family in an afternoon or evening before bed. World of Warcraft never ends. It doesn't end. Imagine that. A game that goes on and on and on and never ever ends. What's that like? What does that mean that kids are coming out of that experience? You know, what do they expect now? What do they want now? They play games that never end. The community of MMOs. MMOs. One of the things that I've discovered about World of Warcraft is that it's not just about playing the game inside the game. There is an enormous outside the game component as well. And if you belong to a persistent group in the game called a guild, one of the things you're expected to do is participate in the discussion forums. You're expected to read the bulletin boards. You're expected to have a voice on the bulletin boards. That's how people get to know you outside of the game. That's how people understand you to be a reliable person, someone they want to play with. There's a whole fan community. These are examples of fan art. These are drawn by people who play World of Warcraft, who may or may not, in their other lives, be professional artists, but who wanted to draw pictures of their characters, and they did. There are people who write fan fiction, stories about World of Warcraft. Some of these are kids who, you know, try to get them to write an essay, but they'll write an incredibly involved story about what happened to them in World of Warcraft or what they wish had happened to them in World of Warcraft. So these kind of things, these MMOs, have an incredible power to draw people in, captivate them, absorb them, and help them create this whole other side of themselves or this whole other world that they can participate in, not only in the game, but outside of it as well. There are people who make movies about World of Warcraft. There's one that I just love, which I'm not going to show it to everybody. It's got some language in it, so if you don't like language, you don't want to see it. But it's a music video. And the point of the video is based on the fact that certain characters in World of Warcraft can only wear cloth armor. Okay, so priests, basically people who cast spells, cannot wear metal armor. And that's sort of a holdover from Dungeons & Dragons. That was true in Dungeons & Dragons. And the idea is that you need your arms free to cast your spells and that kind of thing, and it's also a game balancing thing. But the way that they draw the art for the armor in World of Warcraft is that most cloth armor is a dress. And so you get these big, burly guys in dresses. And for some guys, that's a problem. And so this person made this fantastic music video about how powerful his character is and how he shoots these fireballs that just, you know, destroy stuff. Just, he just doesn't even look at it, and it's gone. And he's got to wear a dress. And it's really, really creative. And he sings. I mean, he's not badly, even. So, list of skills here. Are these useful leadership skills? Role assignment, task delegation, crisis management, logistical planning. Useful leadership skills? Sure. Sure. The ones at the bottom, for those of you who can't see them, motivating group members, dealing with negative attitudes, dealing with group conflicts, and encouraging group loyalty and cohesion. These are all skills recently cited in a research study that people were able to cultivate and develop by leading groups in MMOs. And the group sizes ranged from 5 people up to 40 people. And in some cases, the persistent groups, the guilds, are even bigger than that. You can have hundreds of people in a guild. And there's a guild master, and it's their job to mediate conflict, to establish rules for the guild, a code of conduct, what's going to happen when 2 people want the same item, because only one person can get it. So how do you decide who gets it? And the study cited that the respondents of the study said that they noticed an improvement in their real-life leadership skills after playing this game and being a guild leader or a group master. And the other interesting thing is that the people who reported the most improvement were the younger people, the younger players. What can we learn from designing games? So that was the playing side. What about the designing side? What if we design games ourselves? What if we have students design games? From creating puzzles, we research answers, come up with the questions. Teaching is a good way to learn. Creating a puzzle is a good way to learn. Because to create a good puzzle, you have to know a lot about the thing that you're creating the puzzle about. Designing simple games, you learn game theory, how to make up rules, how to make strategies. These are things that will help later in life as you plan projects, as you manage a family, get along in the workplace. Designing paper-based worlds and adventures like Dungeons & Dragons. Is there anybody who does not know what Dungeons & Dragons is? Okay, that one's been around for a while. It's pretty safe. You can either buy a shelf off-the-shelf module for Dungeons & Dragons and sit down and play it with a group of people, or you can make your own. And as someone who has made them, the amount of work that goes into those things is incredible. I made my own world. I made up a world. So right there, I went and looked up geography so that I would have mountains in the right place. I looked up climatology so that I wouldn't have deserts in the wrong place where no desert could be, because this mattered to me. I made a map of my world, and I printed it out and made it into a sphere, a piece of paper. And I realize not everybody goes to these lengths, but you can. You go into history. I created entire cultures. I created cultures that were no longer around just so there could be a prehistory for the cultures that existed. I created a language. I'm a nerd. But I stand proudly with Tolkien. Politics, which is one of my weak points. But, you know, if you're going to have an adventure that takes place in a city, you've got to have politics. And they've got to be at least marginally believable. Most of my adventures take place in the wilderness because I understand trees and animals better. If you're going to design an online game, you can learn art and illustration, computer science, 3D modeling, working with game engines. I don't advise that any of you go out and design a 3D online world right now. But there are some tools that are being developed that can let you author that kind of thing. So just like with learning objects, there are authoring tools that let you create learning objects. There are authoring tools being developed that will let you create an online world for your discipline. And there's one that Cyprian has worked on, the Antiquities project and ask him, because he'll tell you more about it. But basically, students can create replicas of buildings from ancient Rome, ancient Greece, and you can move around through the spaces. Faculty can create replicas of cities and ask the students to do research in the cities. You can create it as it was. You can create it as it is in ruins. Is that right? I'm not making stuff up here. Okay. So there are tools that let you do that, that let you bring that kind of experience into your course. If you want to be a designer for an online game, you have to be able to draw like that. It's really, really, really a high bar. So these are not, you know, people goofing off. New possibilities, exploration of identity and relationship building. Young people are using MMOs and online worlds to explore their own identity. And there's a common fear that, wow, aren't they all, you know, going online and being somebody that they're not? And isn't that bad? And the thing is that people can't be someone that they're not. Even online, you can't be someone that you're not. If you play a game where you have a persistent character, people will find out really quickly if you're not if you're acting or if you're genuine. Because it's except in rare cases where people have problems, it's very difficult to act like someone else consistently over a long period of time. And relationship building. You can build relationships with people. You can learn about different people who are not like the people that live where you live, simply because a lot of the people in the world that you are playing don't live where you live. I play with somebody who's an Australian. We have a lot of fun with vocabulary. We have a voice chat, a voice over IP, and so we swap, you know, what does this word mean? What does that word mean? We've run into some interesting things. And then three statistics I want to share with you. 30 years, 37 years, and 92%. Not very informative. Okay. 30 years is the average age of a gamer, an American gamer. Your average American gamer is 30 years old. 37 years, the average age of an American game buyer. 92%, the percentage of parents who monitor the games that their children play. Makes me feel better. This is a screenshot from World of Warcraft. This point of this is to show you that it's a really beautiful world. They had some serious artists work on this. The whole world is a very consistent graphical style, which assists in the feeling of immersion when you're there. Another screenshot from World of Warcraft. This is also from World of Warcraft. These are players. These are people. These are individual people. Each one of these. I don't know who they are. I just took a screenshot. They were standing there. The thing about these screenshots, they give you a feel for what the world looks like, but they don't give you a feel for how you interact with the world, how you control it. There are a lot of controls in World of Warcraft. This is the button bar story, for those of you who are waiting for this. When you start playing World of Warcraft for the first time, you have a level one character. You have one button bar, and it has maybe three controls on it. And you learn to master those three controls. As you go up in levels, as you spend more time in the game, you get additional skills. You can put them on the button bar wherever you want them, in any order. You can move them around. And you master them as you go. And you only get maybe three or four at one time. And then you have a long time to master those before you get any more. So by the time you get this many, you've been playing the game for a while, and it makes perfect sense to you. So it looks very complex if you've never played it. My six-year-old could stand here and tell you what all of this is. He doesn't play, because he's still learning to read, but he watches me play sometimes. And he knows what all of these things do, and he could glance at this screenshot and suggest the best course of action for my character, because it has meaning to him, because he's seen it. He's built up that familiarity and that understanding. And he can do that because he wanted to. So what's problematic about games? Pretty nice rosy picture so far, right? But where are the pitfalls? What's the issues? What's the, you know, where is this going to come back and bite us in the butt? Well, making them is hard. Making good games is hard. You can make small-scale games. You can have your students make small-scale games. If you want to make World of Warcraft, you need to go work for Blizzard. You need resources that we simply don't have in education. And that's okay, because the business of education is not creating games. Assessing progress and learning is very difficult with games. How can you tell if the students learned, in addition to learning the rules of the game, which is easy to tell if they learned that or not, how can you tell if they learned the content that you want them to learn? Computers are very good at tracking specific goals. So if your goals that the computer is tracking match with the goals of what you want the students to learn, the computer can, to some degree, tell you how they're doing. But there's still sort of a level behind that, that there's always that question, are they learning the content or are they just learning the game? And this is a really serious problem. And until it's better solved, games are not going to get a huge footing in education. So that's definitely something that people are looking into and working on, but we're far from solving it. And getting people to take them seriously is a problem. So that's why I'm here. But that will come. That will come. People didn't take learning objects seriously in the beginning either. So looking ahead, what's up with educational games? What's coming up? More research and development. More Nick Yee doing more surveys on Daedalus.com, putting that up there. You can search those archives, by the way. I mean, that whole thing is all there. It's great. Just building up that background of research that already exists in every other discipline that's been around forever and that is only just beginning to be built up in educational gaming. More studies, pilots, and anecdotes. More isolated cases of people trying new things, trying new games in their courses, and writing up how it worked, and interviewing the students to see how they liked it and how they functioned and whether they learned anything, and interviewing the faculty to see the same things. More experimentation in online environments, like Second Life, which I'm going to show you in a minute, like the Antiquities Project I mentioned earlier, like anthropology classes going into World of Warcraft and interviewing people, and more games. So let's take a look at Second Life. And what I'm going to show you is called NMC Campus, and it's an environment in Second Life that was built by the New Media Consortium. It's a private community, which means that you have to be admitted to membership, which keeps out a lot of random people and makes it a much safer place to be. Women in particular have had uncomfortable experiences in Second Life because a lot of people don't know how to behave when there's no accountability. But NMC built NMC Campus to explore the possibilities of Second Life for education. And as I said before, Second Life is not a game. It's an online virtual world. So you can go there, you have an avatar, you're looking at the back of my avatar, and you can interact with other avatars. And our question is there anything that's enhanced, anything that we do that's enhanced by being in Second Life? Does it add anything? We are not interested in doing it just because it's there. We're not interested in doing it just to be cool. We're not interested in doing it if it doesn't add anything. But in order to find out if it adds anything, we're doing it so that we can see. And we've had a couple of events in Second Life so far. My boss has taught a couple of guest lectures for graduate courses in Second Life. The students come, the faculty come. He takes them on a tour. He shows them different things. I'm just going to show you a couple things because I don't want to take too long. You can fly in Second Life. It's pretty cool. So this is all... the world exists, and then when I log in, I go into it. The world is persistent when I'm not there. Stuff happens when I'm not there. I want to show you our library. This, by the way, is modeled on the Beneke Library at Yale, if any of you have seen that. And the walls of the actual building at Yale are made out of very thin marble, translucent marble. And when you're inside, the sun shines through the marble and makes it glow. And it's just really beautiful. And the way that we emulated that in this world is that they change color. The panels change color based on the number of people that are around them. So there's only me, so you'll only be able to see the one color. But you can see how it gets yellower. So you see how the panels that I'm standing next to are a warmer yellow than the panels I'm not next to. If more people join me, they go through yellow and orange and red and just get this really nice glow. And we are looking at how you can use Second Life to access the web. So this computer, there's a laptop here on the table. And if I click on this laptop, it will take me to a website. So you can, from inside of Second Life, link out to the web. And we're exploring how that's useful. You can have books in Second Life, which appropriately we store in the library. It'll take a minute to resolve. This is a 2005 Horizon report. And you can actually read it in Second Life. It's easier to read on this screen than that screen. You can turn the pages. And so these are images, and there's a book that as you click, it flips through the images. You can see the pages. It's actually a photographic reproduction of the 2005 Horizon report. And just a sort of a brief glimpse, that's our boardroom in the sky. There. There's a tram that goes up to it. We're very interested in how people are using Second Life for creative expression. And this community center has on the roof a number of sculptures that were created by Second Life artists. So all of these objects were created in Second Life. Well, everything you see was created in Second Life, but they were created by artists, and they're placed there so that people can look at them and in some cases interact with them. And we're exploring, you know, what do people make when they want to create art? How does art work in Second Life?
Are those juried, or does anybody get a chance? Mm-hmm.
It sort of both. We have a sandbox area where anyone can create anything they like, and there's a machine that looks a lot like an ATM, and when you create a sculpture that you like, you deposit a copy of it into the ATM. It gets juried by the NMC Second Life Advisory Board, and if it is interesting enough, it gets put on the roof. Some of these were made by professional sculptors in Second Life. And then the last thing I want to show you is our art gallery. And we worked with SF MoMA, the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, to select some works from their collection. So we have their permission to have these works in here. And this is our art gallery. So we have an actual art show in here, an installation, two of them. On the up spiral is the 20th century figure, and on the down spiral is the variance of form. These are works from SF MoMA's collection. If you click on some of them, you go to an online informational exhibit created in Pachyderm, actually, at SF MoMA about that artwork or artist. If you click on some of them, it takes you to the SF MoMA's website, just their regular website about that artist. And when you touch them, you get a little card that has all of the information that would be on the little wall card in the museum. So the artist and everything, all the attribution information is there. I'm going to end here. What I've...
Oh.
Damn you. I was Cyprian. Your avatar can look like anything. Thanks for that. What I attempted to do before I was derailed by Cyprian is to give you sort of an overview of what people are thinking about when they link education and games. When those thoughts are hooked together in people's heads, what is it that they're talking about? What are they thinking about? Where are we going? Where are we now? And what I hope you'll take away from this is that we're at the very beginning, and we're just beginning to learn, and we're just beginning to find out, but that there could be some really exciting stuff. And I hope that there is. I think that there is. And I'll take your questions.
With this being 2 or 3 years away, to me it seems a lot further away than actually being used in our teaching.
So the question is, how do I come up with it being two, and it actually wasn't me, it was the advisory board, but how do we come up with it being 2 to 3 years away? It seems a lot further away. And the Horizon Report looks at things in terms of when they're going to be in some form in most colleges or universities. And what we're seeing now is that gaming is actually happening in many colleges and universities, but it's in the form of game theory programs or game design programs or in Second Life. The BBC, by the way, has just decided to create a presence in Second Life, so you'll be hearing more about that, I'm sure. There are institutions here and there that are just beginning to use games in the curriculum, and so it's actually present in some places. And so what we're looking at is, when is it going to be not mainstream, but have a sufficient presence that people will say, oh yeah, I actually know of a place where that's happening. If it's not happening right here, you know of a place where it's happening. So the advisory board feels that based on what they've seen so far as current experiences, that it really is that close. We'll see whether it is or not. Sometimes they're wrong. There was a question back here.
Yeah, I have a speculation and a question.
Sure.
The speculation is about the learning the process is separate from learning the content. It seems to me that the future might lie in building an interface in which learning the process is learning the content.
That's a great
idea.
So
that instead of move three spaces up and go to the left, you get an instruction like move on to the second proposition, such and such, or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's the speculation. I don't know if anybody's even thinking of those terms. I imagine somebody must be.
Did everybody hear?
My question has to do... Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Go ahead. I was just making sure.
The question has to do with, in my experience of the students and children that I know, kids are kind of, they're kind of gamers on the one hand and IMers on the other.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody, do you know of anybody kind of working to somehow, I can see IMing being driven by interest in a game,
uh-huh.
but how about the other way around to lead to the game, to lead to the application thing in IM? Is anything going on with that?
So to lead into, educational gaming through the use of IM?
Yeah.
You can carry on games that are text-based, certainly. Are you familiar with MOOS and MUDS, Multi-User Object-Oriented?
No, I'm not.
Okay. It's the sort of predecessor to the MMOs, the virtual worlds, and it's the same thing, but it's all text. So you log in, and instead of being an avatar in a room, you get a text description of where you are.
Okay.
And you can interact with people by typing, by text. So it's sort of, I am in a virtual world, but it's all text-based. And then the second thing is, in World of Warcraft, a lot of the interaction takes place via chat, because most people are not connected by default through voice over IP or some other voice chat. So mostly you type to people, you type back and forth with people, and there's a little section of your screen that's devoted to the chat window, and there are different channels. So there's a channel that everybody can hear, and a channel that only your party can hear, and a channel that only your guild can hear, or see, actually. We say hear, but they're seeing it. So they do overlap. Those two activities do overlap. Yeah.
As a quick observation, Second Life is free, isn't it?
Second Life is free. You can create a character for free. You can't own land with a free character. Or you can't own much land with a free character.
And my question is, today we're seeing a lot of game peripherals, such as the guitar used in Guitar Hero and Dance Dance Revolution pads. Do you see any of these peripherals being used in the future for games to teach practical skills, like real skills, like how to play guitar? Or
sure. Yeah, the question was, there are some peripherals being used in games, like a guitar that's used in... The name of the game was...
It's called Guitar Hero.
Guitar Hero. Intriguing. And is there any... do I see any application for games to teach people real-world skills, like how to play guitar? And I absolutely think so, yeah. Especially with computers and interfaces becoming more and more smaller and more transparent, it'll be very easy to do stuff like that, I would think. So,
yeah. Yeah, I was interested actually in what I'm looking at right now, this moment where you've got permission from MoMA to create an exhibit.
Uh-huh.
And then who wrote up, I mean, I can think of one educational possibility is you have a group of students write up that exhibit in terms of the text and what these are. And you have like a collaborative space in Second Life where a class could meet.
We do.
And work through something like that?
We do. The question was, is there a collaborative space in Second Life where a class could meet? And the gentleman's interested in this exhibit, and in particular in having students curate the exhibit, write up, you know, choose the pieces and write up what they're about and how they tie together. And yes, we have several classroom spaces. There's an open amphitheater, and there are two small classrooms. And I can show you this after if you want to see it. But there are two small classrooms. There are a number of places around the island where you can just kind of talk. You can get together and sit and chat and talk. And we also have, we're experimenting with our own voice over IP server so that you could use your computer and a headset and just connect to this thing and have voice conversations with people without using a phone as well.
Time management. How do you manage all the things that one wants to do in a day in a 24-hour period with this type of technology?
That's right.
Time management. I think you may be referring to the fact that these kind of games, like World of Warcraft, for example, are huge time sink.
Well, also, I spend more time than I should watching TV, which is totally
sure.
Sure. So, you know, trade-offs.
Yeah,
in our lifestyles.
It is. Interestingly, well, maybe not interestingly, but a little fact, since I started playing World of Warcraft, I watch 0 hours of television a week. I didn't watch much before I started. I mean, I was maybe in the 5 hours a week range. But I don't watch any. I watch videos in the evening, but I don't watch TV at all. I watch The Daily Show sometimes. that was a choice that I made, is I choose to do this instead of doing that. But as a full-time employee and as a full-time parent and as somebody who travels a lot and somebody who has a house to clean, I have to make those choices. You know, and I think it's the same choices that were made that are made by people who watch TV and by people who read a lot of books and by people who play a lot of sports. And it's basically you choose to put your time where you want to put your time, but there is that question of balance. Because would I sit there and play World of Warcraft all day? Sure, sometimes on my day off, that's what I do. But I have to get work done so I don't do journal. Except when I get to come here and show it to you. And World of Warcraft, the servers are down this morning because they take them down on Tuesday mornings for maintenance, which is a whole software nightmare that we don't have to go into. But I will do a demo of that maybe later today or tomorrow. We'll find a little hole. So if you want to see what World of Warcraft actually looks like, I can do it.
So can you get online in Second Life and get back on Second Life?
Can you get online in Second Life and get... I don't understand.
You can go to the library and get online. Can you get online to Second Life?
Oh, yes. Okay. So the question somewhat facetiously, I think, was can you be in Second Life and get online and go back to Second Life? Actually, yes. You can have a URL that takes you from a web browser to a specific location in Second Life. So I could create a teleporter that when I was in Second Life, if I clicked on it, would open a web browser that would take me back to Second Life to a different location. Yes.
That's the same character.
Yeah.
Okay, that's great.
So you don't have multiple characters, it's the one character being...
You can have multiple characters, you can only log in with one at a time. You, just like in this world, you can only be one person at a time.
It seems like getting students to commit to... We call it being engaged, but in some sense it's to commit, to raise their hand for class discussion, or to blog, or to, you know, do whatever participatory thing is difficult.
Yeah.
And has anybody looked into how the use of avatars might facilitate that?
People are beginning to. The question is, has anyone looked into how the use of avatars might facilitate students wanting to participate in cases where it's hard sometimes to get them to participate? And those studies are beginning to be done. That's one of the things that we're exploring in Second Life, is when we get a class in there, are people who are normally quiet less quiet? Is this somehow an opening to them that they can express themselves better? And actually, there has been research with the text-based worlds, the MOOCs that I mentioned earlier, and I can't cite the research offhand, but I know that there has been some as far as are people more likely to speak up? And it turns out that in some cases, yes, people who are shy of speaking out in class have less problem typing out a question or comment in a virtual world.
There is research that shows that occurs in discussion boards as well.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found is that after learning to do it on discussion boards, I've had shy students who will then start talking in the classroom. So,
cool.
I'd be happy to tell you a story about how one of my students hijacked World of Warcraft for his own educational purposes and actually made it quite useful.
I would like to hear that.
But here's my question. A lot of us sitting in this room might want to experiment or might want to hijack or might want to appropriate games that exist. Is there an inventory that says, here's a bunch of games that develop this skill set, here's another set of games that develop this skill set, PlayStation 2, NCAA basketball is great for teaching this other skill set.
Mm-hmm.
Does such an inventory exist?
That's a great question. That would be a great resource. I haven't seen one. The question was, is there an inventory somewhere that says these games teach these skills so you can easily match it so you can experiment? What I have seen is bits and pieces of research that said we looked at this game and we found that it taught these skills. But those kinds of claims are difficult to just make. So, now I have all kinds of ideas about, you know, what... I'm thinking of Merlot and the learning objects and how people go to Merlot and they say, yes, I used this learning object and I used it this way and it did this for my students. We should have that for games. So you want to work on that? That would be great, though. That would be an awesome resource.
Sounds like a new project has been born. That's what we're looking for here. Let's give our thanks and appreciation.
You've been listening to Rachel Smith from the New Media Consortium talking about gaming and education at Faculty Academy 2006. You'll find more information about Faculty Academy at www.facultyacademy.org. Thanks for listening.